In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, former representatives Democrat Steve Israel and Republican Zach Womp discuss the removal of Kevin McCarthy as House Speaker and what it means for House Republicans and the functioning of Congress. Then, Bloomberg Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr previews the major cases before the High Court this term, including on gun rights, abortion medication, and social media. Plus, political education reporter Michael Stratford discusses the resumption of federal student loan payments this month and what the Biden administration hopes to do to help borrowers. First, two former members of Congress discuss the historic ouster of Representative Kevin McCarthy as Speaker this week and what it means for the functioning of this Congress and the future of the institution.
Our guests, two former House members with over three decades of service between them. New York Democrat Steve Israel served from 2001 to 2017, and Tennessee Republican Zach Womp served from 1995 to 2011. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Congressman Womp, I want to start with you. Your views on what happened with Kevin McCarthy this week. Was it a failure of the institution of the House, the system, the rules in the House, or was this a failure of Kevin McCarthy and his political abilities to read his own conference?
Well, I think it's like snatching defeat out of the jaws of victory. Chip Roy, who frankly is kind of the intellectual leader of the conflict they had back in January when Speaker McCarthy was first elected, he called it a circular firing squad because this is sort of a one-off thing. I don't think you can compare it to any event in U.S. history because it's internal. It's not like us fighting with the president or some kind of battle between the House and the Senate. It's internal to the House and even within one party. So in a sense, it's really unfortunate as a Republican, because instead of us being able to focus on, you know, the inadequacies of President Biden or even the Senate Democrats, we're actually kind of throwing it all on ourselves here when it, just from the outside looking in, it looked to me like McCarthy survived, you know, even getting elected speaker, which was impressive, to be honest with you. I was never really a great Kevin McCarthy guy, but back in May, I saw him and I said, you know, you really showed me something I didn't know you had. And that was the tenacity and the determination. You know, being speaker, even with a 10 vote majority, is still the hardest job in Washington. So in a sense, this band of guys, this and Nancy Mace is sort of a one off, because even Chip Roy, who led the concern about McCarthy in January, he said no to this motion to vacate. In fact, he kind of challenged all those people because he's actually a conservative and he's a thought leader. These people aren't thought leaders. On each individual eight decision vote, it's a whole variety of different reasons as to why they voted this way. Personally, I don't think they knew what they were getting into, because now chaos ensues. I don't know how this is going to come out next week, but if we do have a battle between Jordan and Scalise, then it's really sort of a decision about the future of the party, which way we're going to go, more towards Reagan conservatism or more towards Trump populism. And that's probably the biggest question internally right now for Republicans.
And just to put a fine point on it, which one is the more towards Reagan conservatism and which one is the more towards Trump populism?
Well, Jordan has been a traditional conservative, but he is such a Trump loyalist that 5 days after January the 6th, President Trump presented him the Medal of Freedom, which caused a lot of us to kind of look up and think, what? You know, so he is such a Trump loyalist, even though he is a traditional conservative. Matt Gaetz is a populist. A lot of these younger, newer members, not a lot of younger, newer members, but a lot of the members now, because of social media, are more they're looking for clicks. They're looking for fame. They're not really policy people. Chip Roy is a policy person. He's more like Tom Coburn from the past. He's a real student of the Constitution. That's why he wasn't going to have anything to do with this.
I want to bring in Steve Israel, a Democrat of New York. If you're a Democrat sitting in the House today, Steve Israel, who do you want to see as the next speaker if it had to be either a Jim Jordan or a Steve Scalise?
Well, first, let me tell you how wonderful it is to be on with my old friend, Congressman Zach Womp. He and I served together on the Appropriations Committee in a place and at a time when Democrats and Republicans could actually sit down and work things out without fear of retaliation and reprisal and retribution. So, Zach, it's good to be on with you. Look, if you're a Democrat, number one, you want the institution to succeed. We have divided government. Like it or not, there is a Democratic president. There is a Democratic majority in the Senate. There is a Republican majority in the House. Fundamentally, for anything to happen, you need a leader of the Republicans who can negotiate in good faith, who can unify his or maybe at some point her caucus, who can engage in the kinds of conversations, adult conversations that are necessary to get to a positive outcome and a compromise on the fundamental challenges facing the United States of America. Democrats are not reveling in what happened. Democrats are nervous and anxious about what happened. The purging of Kevin McCarthy, it's not just a matter of being bad for the Republican Party. It's bad for the institution of Congress. It's bad for the country. And Democrats also are looking abroad, quite honestly, looking at places like China and Russia. Our adversaries around the world are looking at this as a sign of fundamental instability in the American process, and they are reveling in this. We need to get our act together. We need to Republicans need to elect a speaker who can help restore some sanity to the United States Congress and help us address those massive challenges. First and foremost, the safety and security of the American people.
Do you think, Congressman Israel, that Matt Gaetz has a point when he says that power on Capitol Hill and in the House specifically has become too centralized in the hands of leadership, and that's a bad thing for individual members of Congress? Does he have a point there?
Look, they don't. The Republican conference doesn't let me in the room, right? So I can't pontificate about the internal dynamics of the distribution of power within the Republican conference.
Does that happen in the Democratic caucus?
But in the Democratic caucus, you know, we don't have motions to vacate. We don't have attacks. We've never had this. Think about this. When Zach and I were in Congress, we saw the right wing of the Republican Party try and take out John Boehner, and he ended up leaving Capitol Hill, take out Paul Ryan, and he ended up leaving Capitol Hill, and then successfully take out Kevin McCarthy. Meanwhile, I have to say, on the Democratic side, it has been at times loud and at times messy. But we have been able to unify around our values, around our priorities, around our policies. And we have compromised with Republicans, understanding that the Constitution has three branches of government and that the Congress itself is divided in a two-party system. And so those power dynamics that we have seen in the Republican conference have not translated at all to the Democratic caucus. Now, let's just say one more thing on this. Look, this argument that Matt Gaetz and others are doing this because they want regular order, which is a term for a nice and clean and dependable and predictable process, is ludicrous on its face. This is the caucus of disorder. They aren't doing this because they want neater, cleaner, fairer rules. They're doing this because they want power and because it helps get followers on social media and it makes them famous. And that is my fundamental objection to what is happening.
On that last point, Congressman Wamp, would you agree?
Well, there's no question that the regular order, like when Steve and I served on the Appropriations Committee, we actually passed appropriations bills in the House and the Senate, and we actually conferenced between the House and the Senate, and we brought those bills back individually, and we didn't operate under a continuing resolution all the time, which is kicking the can down the road. It leads to an omnibus bill. It's a sloppy approach, and that's become the order of the day over the last decade. And so everyone, frankly, on both sides has some consternation about that, because that's not the way this was envisioned. It's not the way it used to operate. They thought we were radicals back in 1994 when I was elected, but they'd love to have us back now because we actually respected the institution and the traditions of how we would work together and hammer these things out. I sat on multiple conference committees with Robert Byrd back in the day from West Virginia on the other side, and we hammered out these compromises. So they have a point, but this is not the way to go about changing it. In fact, I would argue Steve Israel and I are both associated with a group called Issue One, which is a group of 200 former members of Congress in a bipartisan way. We promoted the Committee on Modernization of Congress, and their recommendations are that individual members have more rights under the rules, that amendments can be offered on the floor to appropriations bills, that you wouldn't just throw everything together from the leadership and make everybody vote up or down. But I think if you're going to make these systemic changes, you actually have to do it in a bipartisan way. You have to work together. And that's what we've promoted as former members, that you can't just do it one party or the other. And these guys almost are like children, that they's like, do it my way or we're going to take our ball and go home. Well, now what are they going to do? You know, and they didn't even consider that the Senate is in the hands of the Democrats. I mean, back in the day when Tom Coburn and all of us came into office, we actually shut the government down. But we had a plan, you know, with the Senate Republicans to bring Bill Clinton to the table to negotiate. It led to the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, which led to three consecutive years of a balanced federal budget. We actually had a strategy, a game plan. We knew where we were going with this. They have no idea where they were going with this. The Matt Gaetz-led crowd, that's why Chip Roy, who, again, is an honorable guy and a true conservative, he wasn't going to have anything to do with it. So I think they don't even know what they're doing, and here we are. Now, it's going to lead to some choices, and so some good could come out of it. But like Steve said, they need to get their act together, because the country's looking at Washington right now on every aspect, the executive branch and the Congress losing faith by the minute.
That was former members of Congress, Democrat Steve Israel and Republican Zach Wamp. Next, the Supreme Court returned to Washington this week to start its new term. Bloomberg Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr previews the cases to watch.
Broadly, if you had to break this down into big issues to expect this time around, how would you do that?
Well, at this point, we don't have any of the blockbuster cases like the abortion case or the affirmative action case from the previous terms. But there are a lot of hot button social issues that are either at the court or likely to be there. It includes a gun case, a potential abortion case. There might be a transgender rights case. And then there are a lot of cases about the structure of government that are perhaps a little more wonky, but very, very important for the power of administrative agencies here in Washington.
With the cases that are to be considered, you write that a lot of these cases come from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Can you explain what the court is, and then why so many of these cases appear?
So this is a federal appeals court that it oversees Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. It is, I think, pretty much without question, the most conservative federal appeals court in the country. And conservative litigants, including like the state of Texas, like to file cases there. And the Fifth Circuit has issued a number of rulings, many of which are before the Supreme Court this year, that go beyond, are more conservative than the Supreme Court has yet allowed. And that includes this gun case I'm sure we'll be talking about. And so one of the questions, one of the themes of this term is, does this conservative Supreme Court want to go as far as the Fifth Circuit?
You brought up guns, Mr. Storr. One of those is about guns and if domestic abusers can own them. Can you set the stage there?
Sure. Go back a couple terms. The Supreme Court says there's a constitutional right to carry a weapon in public. The court in that case set up a really tough new test for gun regulation, saying they basically have to have a historical analog. We look at history and tradition, and if we can't find something back in 1789 or around then that looks like the regulation we're looking at today, it's unconstitutional. So with that as the backdrop, the Fifth Circuit took up this case involving the federal law that says, if you are subject to a domestic violence restraining order, you can lose your gun rights. And a man named Mr. Rahimi was prevented from owning a firearm. And he subsequently was involved in, at least allegedly, several shootings, threatened. He originally threatened his girlfriend with a gun, physically abused her, accused of threatening another woman. And the question is whether he still retains his Second Amendment rights. The Fifth Circuit said, yes, he does. And the Supreme Court has agreed to take up the Biden administration's appeal of that ruling.
And what's the Biden administration's case in this matter?
Well, their case is, first of all, this history and tradition test doesn't require you to find the exact thing, that that when you go back and look into history, back in 1789, we weren't talking about domestic abusers, and that doesn't have to be the test here. And they also say this is a case where we have an individualized finding. A judge found that this person was dangerous. And in that context, surely the Second Amendment doesn't let him go out and get a weapon and potentially use it against somebody else.
Go back in time a little bit to 2022, where the court took actions on the Second Amendment on a standalone Could that play into what they have to decide this time around?
Yeah, absolutely. If they are going to say, no, this man does not have a Second Amendment right, they're going to have to deal with that test they set up back in 2022. They're going to have to sort of explain why finding an exact historical analog isn't always the test. They're going to have to provide a little more flexibility for governments in setting up gun restrictions. And if not, then really it's hard to see how any gun restriction of any significance is going to survive Second Amendment review with this court.
Again, that's one of the cases to be considered. Greg Storr, our guest. One of those other cases, Mr. Storr, came from as a result of the Obama administration, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It being considered on its own when it comes to its operation and particularly its funding. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. This was a case that was argued just yesterday. The question, again, it's a case out of the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit said the way the CFPB gets its funding is unconstitutional. It draws its money from the Federal Reserve. It's not subject to the year-to-year congressional appropriation. So it wouldn't have been subject to the government shutdown had that happened, for example. The CFPB is this agency, just by way of background, set up after the 2008 financial crisis, regulates things like mortgages, home loans, consumer products. And conservatives and Republicans have long said it's unaccountable, has too much power. The question is whether the Supreme Court will try to roll back the CFPB in this way. The arguments yesterday suggested they were pretty skeptical of this argument that the funding mechanism is unconstitutional.
And so as far as the justices themselves, as they were questioning, there's reporting that they had pretty sharp questions about, particularly coming from the lawyer representing the challengers.
Yeah. So even like Justice Thomas, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Barrett, some of the conservative justices were really questioning whether this agency, well, first of all, whether the CFPB was any different from a lot of other agencies, including, say, the Customs Service, which was set up at the time of the founding, in terms of how they get their funding. And then secondly, Justice Thomas asked a question where he said, look, you may be right that this is something new and different, but even so, what's the constitutional problem? You have to give us a real constitutional argument, and the argument that this appropriations clause somehow limits Congress's discretion in setting up an agency, it didn't sound like there was a whole lot of support for that argument.
And on the topic of regulatory power, as we're talking about it, you're going to have to give us a little legal 101. There's a topic, or at least a case, taking a look at a topic known as Chevron deference. Its implications there. First of all, what is it and how does it apply to what the justices will hear?
Sure. The Chevron deference is this doctrine that was established in 1984 by the Supreme Court. And it goes to the question of who gets to interpret ambiguous statutes, or who has the primary role in interpreting ambiguous statutes. Is it the agency or is it a court? And in the Chevron case, the court said, if an agency interprets an ambiguous term in a statute, and if that interpretation is reasonable, we, the courts, are going to defer to the agency. Now, back when it happened, conservatives liked that ruling because they kind of liked what agencies were doing, and liberals didn't like it, and now things have flipped. It's conservatives who are unhappy with the Chevron doctrine, liberals who tend to want to defend it. The court is considering abolishing that doctrine, overturning that. It's a case that arises out of fishing rules in New Jersey. And, it may be that the conservatives who have been sort of after the Chevron doctrine may say to themselves, it's not really doing a whole lot of work anymore. We've already limited it, and so we don't actually need to overturn it. But certainly this is a court that is skeptical of the power of administrative agencies. And so one would expect they would at least narrow the Chevron doctrine even more.
That was Greg Storr, Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News. Next, federal student loan payments resume this month after the pandemic hiatus. Political education reporter Michael Stratford discusses what it means for borrowers.
Michael Stratford, the president yesterday was out talking about student loans. What did he have to say?
Well, what the president announced yesterday was the latest bucket of targeted student debt relief that his administration has approved. Really, since the beginning of the administration, the Education Department has been working on making changes to various existing programs that provide debt relief and student debt cancellation to borrowers. Those changes have been happening sort of on a parallel track to the broader question of whether the administration can cancel large amounts across the board of student debt across the board for borrowers. And what the administration did yesterday was really focus on targeted individual groups of borrowers. So, for example, the administration announced that some number of borrowers will receive debt relief under the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which offers public service workers, those working for the government or nonprofits, the opportunity to have their debts canceled after 10 years of making payments. That was a program that was really marred in administrative problems, bureaucratic obstacles for borrowers. The administration made some changes to make it easier for borrowers to get relief under that program. And yesterday, a handful, several thousands of them received relief. The administration, there were a couple other buckets of relief the administration announced yesterday, including relief for borrowers who have been in repayment on their loans for more than 20 years and haven't been able to pay it off. In a lot of cases, borrowers were seeing their balances increase, even though they might have been paying because of compounding interest on their loans. And then finally, the administration announced that a group of borrowers who have severe and permanent disabilities would be able to receive loan discharges. That's an existing federal program. Borrowers who develop severe disabilities after taking out their loan are entitled under federal law to have their debts forgiven. But again, that's another program that had been sort of difficult for borrowers to access because of administrative barriers, paperwork. And so what the administration did yesterday was automate that process for borrowers who the Social Security Administration had already determined were disabled.
So, Michael Stratford, if you didn't fall into those buckets that you just talked about and you've been getting some relief from your student loans due to the pandemic legislation or ruling, what can you expect now?
Well, for the vast majority of federal student loan borrowers, payments are resuming this month for the first time since March 2020 at the beginning of the pandemic, as you mentioned. At that time, first President Trump and then Congress and President Biden enacted a series of pauses and freezes on federal student loans. So borrowers haven't, and most federal student loan borrowers haven't had to pay since the beginning of the pandemic. As part of the debt ceiling deal that President Biden and then Speaker McCarthy struck earlier this year, the pandemic relief program for student loan borrowers ended as part of that deal. And so this month, 28 million federal student loan borrowers will receive bills if they haven't already and be required to pay for the first time. So those borrowers, there are various relief programs available to them if they're having trouble repaying their loans for the first time since the pandemic, including what the administration is promoting sort of at the top of the list, which is its new SAVE plan, an income-driven repayment plan that's aimed at lowering payments for borrowers.
Yeah, saving on a valuable education plan, the SAVE plan, as you just said. Just a few more details about that. Raises amount of income shielded from repayment calculation from 150% to 225% of the federal poverty line. Caps payments for undergraduate loans to 5% of income, waives interest accrual that exceeds borrower's monthly payment, and loan forgiveness after 10 years worth of payments for anyone who borrowed $12,000 or less. Michael Stratford, I want to show our viewers what the president had to say yesterday on these incremental steps that he's been making.
In total, my administration has canceled $127 billion in student debts for nearly 3.6 million Americans. This kind of relief is life-changing for individuals and their families, but it's good for our economy as a whole as well. By freeing millions of Americans from the crushing burden of student debt, it means they can go and get their lives in order. They can think about buying a house. They can start a business. They can be starting a family. This matters. It matters in their daily lives.
Michael Strutford, the Supreme Court overturned his first original debt cancellation plan. So how has he been able to do this?
Yeah, it's a little confusing because there was that big Supreme Court ruling earlier this summer that a lot of student loan borrowers were waiting for and didn't go the way that many of them had hoped. The Supreme Court ruled that the president's first student debt relief program, which had been tied to the pandemic, or the pandemic was a justification, was illegal, that the president exceeded his authority in trying to achieve that. What the administration has been doing from the beginning is to sort of work on different buckets of student debt relief. So I mentioned earlier the targeted segments of borrowers, borrowers who work in public service, borrowers who develop severe and permanent disabilities, borrowers who have been paying a long time but haven't been able to pay off their loans after decades. They've also forgiven a lot of debt under a separate program designed to discharge loans when the education department finds that a college has engaged in some misconduct. So it's misled students into enrolling at their institution or cheated them in some way. That's known as the Borrower Defense to Repayment Program. The administration has forgiven billions of dollars under that program as well. So the administration's strategy from the beginning has been to work on these individual relief programs that are tied to existing programs, aren't a new sweeping program like the one that the Supreme Court struck down. At the same time, the administration has said it's not giving up on broad-based debt cancellation. It's moving through a new regulatory process. They're trying to use a different law than the emergency pandemic-related authority that the Supreme Court disapproved of earlier this year. And that process is moving along. It's slow. It's part of the regulatory process. So the Education Department needs to go through public hearings. It's forming a committee to hammer out the details of those proposals. That committee is actually meeting for the first time next week. But that's going to be a long, long process, and the administration expects it will take months, potentially up to a year, to finalize a new broad-based debt relief program.
That was Michael Strutford, education reporter for Politico.
Thanks for listening to the Washington Journal podcast. We want to make sure you know about our latest podcast, Books That Shaped America. It's a companion podcast to our 10-week television series of the same name. We've teamed up with the Library of Congress and selected 10 books from across American history that have had a major impact on our society. Each week, the C-SPAN television program will focus on one of these books and its impact. This companion podcast will give you more background on the book's authors. If you want to learn more about Books That Shaped America, go to our website, c-span.org. The podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts.